Welcome to This Is Your Sporting Life with Peter Donegan for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
And it is great to have your company for another edition of This Is Your Sporting Life as we celebrate the lives of famous Australian sports people. And my guest this morning is one of those very rarest of breeds because he can put after his name Olympic champion. Russell Mark, good to see you.
Yeah, good morning.
That is a very special title, isn't it?
Look, I guess as a sportsman, it's the one event you want to win. I'd won all the others prior to the Atlanta Olympics. I'd won the World Cup and the World Cup final and the World Championship. But the one thing I hadn't won was the Olympic Games. And went close in Barcelona, but I had 4 years to think about it. And luckily enough, I was in a sport that I got a chance to redeem myself. And yeah, once I got the title of Olympic champion, it was certainly easier to sleep at night.
Does it change your life? Do people look at you differently? Do people approach you differently when you are known as the Olympic champion?
Look, I think it gives you opportunities, Peter. I would hate to think I'm a different person, but you'd be denying yourself, I guess, the opportunities in life that the Olympic gold medal does give you if you didn't go down that path. So I probably took a different career path. I went over to Atlanta as a professional real estate valuer and I came home as a professional shooter. I signed a contract as a professional the night that I won the Olympics in Atlanta. I sort of actually had achieved my dream and then turned into a professional, which it really should have been the other way around. But because I was from Australia, you didn't get the opportunity to become a professional until you'd proved to the people that were paying that you could win the Olympics. And I signed a contract with a company in Italy called Beretta, which were the biggest manufacturer of firearms in the world, to become a professional athlete. And I did that right through until I retired at the end of 2014.
Speaking of Beretta, you've had that long association with them. They're a very famous name in the sport. How do you tell a good gun from a not-so-good gun? Is it only after you've fired it that you know whether it's a good gun or not?
Yeah, look, I made my name, I guess, with a model of this particular brand of Beretta called an SO5, which wouldn't mean much to you, but for the people in the shooting world, it's a $35,000 gun. It's not like it's just a gun that you buy in a gun shop in Thornbury or somewhere. It's all handmade, and it's made to the finest of millimetres. And if you're at a particular body weight, you fly over to Beretta at their factory near Brescia and they'll build you that gun based around your body. So they put an enormous amount of work into getting it exactly right. So the gun then doesn't become a factor in why you miss. It takes away that excuse because that gun will shoot perfectly accurate every time as long as you do the same thing every time. The steel in the barrels obviously is a big thing, but the fact that it's handmade by the world's best gun makers makes a huge difference.
How many people would they do that for, Russ? How many people would individually have weapons made for them?
Oh, at the Olympic Games, they don't all use $35,000 guns, but all of them would be individually made for that level of athlete because you're talking 1% separating about 10 people at the Olympic Games and it becomes very, very much, it's the smallest of margins will win you. So any advantage you have over the others is huge, but everyone would have a custom-made gun.
While we're talking about the Olympics, let's keep talking about it. I've spoken to a lot of people over the years and I have been privileged to be in a stadium where the Australian National Anthem is played. You're standing on the top step of the dais and your National Anthem is played. What is that experience like?
Yeah, it's a very interesting question for me to answer. And I think people just think that you would remember the National Anthem or the weight of the gold medal around your neck or maybe even the flag going up the pole. I actually can't remember any of that because there were three or four people that were in my team of people from Barcelona all the way through to Atlanta that I actually looked back in the crowd and saw them actually crying because I'd won. And I realised at that particular moment by me achieving my goal of getting the Olympic gold medal, I'd actually made these people achieve their goal also. And it really distracted me. It distracted from the whole medal presentation. And I've looked back at the video now and you can see I'm actually not really focused on what was going on. I was focusing on some people in the crowd. And it's the unfortunate part of the Olympics that your team of people can't get on the dais with you. It's the athlete that gets all the individual accolades, but it's not your sports psych or your masseur or your coach. None of those guys get any sort of media coverage. It's the athlete. But that distracted me enough that I can't remember any of the medal presentation. And I look at the video now and I think, God, I wish I had that time again and I would have focused a little more on myself, but I can't really remember it.
So given that's the case, did that make you more intent on trying to get the gold medal in your home Olympics, which would have added another dimension to it?
Look, I was a realist. I was 32 when I won in Atlanta. I was probably at the back end of a really good run. You know, I'd won the World Championship and the World Cup final and that all in the previous couple of years. And I reckon about 32 was as far as I could have stretched it. But I went on to win another World Championship after Atlanta and I won another World Cup. And Sydney, I finished second and by the closest of margins. But I think a lot of people, even myself, deep down knew the guy that actually won the gold medal was the best shooter in the world at the time. And if someone had have offered me a place in the final on the night before when I was in the bus heading back to the village, I probably would have said, yeah, just give me a place in the final. A medal was probably unrealistic. I wasn't shooting that well by 2000. But, yeah, I nearly pulled off another gold medal. But to get into the Olympic final, I thought, was an achievement. To get a medal out of it, I thought, was great.
I think it's interesting that you say that you were pushing it out to 32 years of age, but you shot for another 14 years at the top level.
Yeah, I mean, probably not to the same level. I'd won another World Cup, I think, in 2003, and by then I was well past my best, but I actually got the number one ranking in the world back in 2003, just for a brief period, but it was a goal that I'd set myself the year prior after the Manchester Commonwealth Games, because I've got very close to getting there again and finally got it. And I think from that moment, I was never quite the same. I never had the same fire in my belly after 2003. And it's a hard thing because you set your whole life to win the Olympics. I never set my life up to win two Olympics. But I kept maintaining some form, and Beretta kept pumping money into me to use their products. So I was having a very good life, and to walk away from it, I was walking away from something that a lot of people fantasized about, just being part of the team. And yeah, when I retired at 50, I was in a very famous photograph in Spain at the last event I competed in, with three young boys whose fathers I competed with at the 88 Olympics in Seoul. And it sort of makes you realise how old you've become in the sport. But only good memories. I have no regrets.
So what is it that wanes over time? Is it physically? Is it mentally? Is it the hunger to compete? Or is it perhaps in your case that you may have achieved success a little bit earlier than you thought that you would?
Yeah, look, that's a really good question. And I think it's a combination of a lot of things. But undoubtedly, the biggest one is family. Once you have kids and you get married and you have other focuses, up until 96, I had no other focus in my life except winning the Olympic Games. But then you have children, and then all of a sudden you don't train quite as often as probably what you should, because you're going to kids' functions that you want to go to, and you miss particular competitions that maybe you shouldn't. But it's finding a balance, and I think a professional athlete, the successful ones, no matter who they are, they're totally focused on winning the competition. Well, after 96, I can't honestly say I was 100% focused. I tried to get a good mixture of business, and, you know, I've gone and invested heavily into some real estate, and other things in my life started to take control. And you can't compete forever, and there's nothing worse than seeing a sportsman at the end of their career with nothing to show for it. Mm. And you see it often with AFL footballers, sadly. You know, you see them going to sportsmen's nights and you think, God, you were such a champion, but you've really got nothing to show for it. I can honestly say I invested heavily into different things that, when my sporting career was finally over, at least I had some material things to show for it.
You mentioned family, and we'll talk a little bit more about family later on, and we'll talk about Lauren and your relationship, and it won't come as any surprise that the phrase batting above your average or fighting out of your weight division might get mentioned there at some stage.
Yeah, Lauren, she was a competitor for the US shooting team, and we met at a World Cup competition in, I think it was about the end of 98, and yeah, I thought I wouldn't mind her shooting for Australia. And I went and spoke to the hierarchy, and they thought shooting for Australia for Lauren would be good too. And she finally moved to Australia and met the residency requirements just in time to compete for the 2002 Commonwealth Games team. And she made a tough decision to give up her right to shoot for the US. And she went to Manchester and won the Commonwealth Games at her first ever competition for Australia. So she sort of got a bit of a fan club just by doing that. But yeah, and we've had a couple of kids, and that's probably taken the focus off Lauren's shooting career, because she'll never put the sport in front of motherhood, which is a great thing. I absolutely have no problems with that. But yeah, she's been a good person for me to be with, because she's been a fellow competitor, and you go through some big lows as well as some big highs, and it's handy to have someone there that can actually understand that.
One of the things that was interesting, and we'll talk about your situation with Lauren and what you went through as far as trying to be a couple at the Olympic Games, that coming up a little bit later on. The photo shoot that Lauren did for Zoo attracted a fair bit of controversy. What was your view on all of that?
Yeah, look, a lot of people don't realise that Lauren was first approached that to try and raise some money for a foundation for Elisa Camplin. Elisa and Lauren are quite close friends, and it raised a lot of awareness and a lot of money, which we all donated to that campaign. She copped a lot of criticism for it, but a lot of people don't know the story behind the scenes. It raised a lot of profile for our sport. And, of course, you know, Lauren's a reasonably attractive woman, and it certainly it didn't hurt her profile, I guess, for that. But there was a lot of things involved in, but unfortunately, it was probably the wrong time. And just before that photo shoot was to be released, you had two swimmers walked over to a gun shop in San Diego in the States and posed with some firearms, and they got into all sorts of trouble with it. And Zoo magazine probably put that on the end of that story, and to sort of show, well, here's an Olympic athlete with a gun. And it was probably promoted the wrong way. And, of course, it came at a time where we were both in the Olympic team, and I requested that we room together at the London Olympics. And we'd roomed together all of our competitions for 10 years prior to that. And I just thought that was a really simple request. It turned out to be a very hard request for the Olympic team to fulfill. And Nick Green, I guess, who was the chef de mission at the time, we were pretty tight. We were on the board together at the VOC. And I just thought this was a request that could have just taken place outside of the media. And it didn't. Request was denied, and I guess the media heard about it. I think Red Simons talked about it at the ABC one morning, and it became a national story. And I didn't really want to back down on it, because I wanted to room with her, because I thought it would help both of our performances. And it became a social media event, and in the end, it distracted us both from London. It doesn't provide an excuse, because you need to be above all of that, but it was a distraction, there's no doubt. And I dare say if Lauren had her time again, she would have done it a year before the Olympics or a year after, but not the week of.
When you went to Glasgow and all of a sudden they checked you in and they said, Mr. Mark, here's your room with a double bed, that must have come as some sort of relief.
Look, Steve Monteghetti was the chef de mission in Glasgow, and Steve and I grew up together in Ballarat. And Steve is no idiot by any means. He wasn't going to go through the publicity of this, and long before we got to Glasgow, that was decided on. So it was never spoken about, and we did all have a laugh about it, because, I don't know, I guess you guys on this show are the first to hear about it, but in London, we roomed together anyway. I mean, our team just moved everything around behind the scenes, and Lauren and I behind the scenes just roomed together, because all of our team knew that that's what we did, and our team managers just turned a blind eye.
So Nick Green knew about that?
Nick Green probably didn't know about it, but Nick Sullivan, who was the shooting team manager, did know about it, because we roomed in the same apartment that he roomed in.
What do you reckon Nick Green would have said had he have known about it at the time, given the fact that ostensibly you would have been defying orders?
Yeah, I would have put Nick Green in a very awkward situation, but I was very angry by the fact that we had to go to that level, and I was very grateful for our team for just hiding it, and we just moved on with it. But yeah, I don't know. I think Nick Green unfortunately had a lot of pressure put on him by certain individuals within the Australian Olympic Committee that were trying to make an example of us. And it was wrong. They weren't happy with the photo shoot with Zoo magazine. They were, certainly weren't happy with that on the back of the two swimmers getting all that negative publicity. And it was sort of like showing them, well, here's an Olympian with a gun. What are you going to do about this one? And they took it the wrong way. I don't think Nick Green took it the wrong way, but he was just told what he had to do. And I don't know, everything sort of went wrong for Nick Green at those Olympics, and he ended up losing the job as chef de mission, which I thought was really unfair, because forget the problem I had with Nick about it. I thought he did a good job as the leader of the team, and I'd still say he was the right guy to replace John Coates. But yeah, I never spoke to Nick about it. I certainly was summoned to his office when I arrived in London, and I went to the news conference and we didn't speak about it, because our team had just said, well, we'll room you together anyway. And that team manager's now moved on. He's no longer involved in the shooting organisation. I would have felt that they may have taken it out on him and probably not me.
You talked about the image of your sport. We'll take a break, and on the other side of the break, we'll talk about that Olympic gold medal and the events that happened just a few months before that and what it caused for your sport. The Olympic champion, Russell Mark, is my special guest on This Is Your Sporting Life. More coming up after the break for Tobin Brothers, Celebrating Lives.
You're listening to This Is Your Sporting Life with Peter Donegan for Tobin Brothers Funerals, Celebrating Lives.
And it's great to have your company for another edition of This Is Your Sporting Life. The Olympic champion, Russell Mark, is with me. Russ, we mentioned that 1996 Olympic championship. It was just a few short months before that one of the most momentous events in this nation's history took place in Port Arthur. And clearly that was going to have an impact on the sport of shooting. Do you think that overall we've done the right thing differentiating between sporting shooting and the other stuff that goes on that is a scourge in many societies around the world?
Yeah, look, as a shooter, it was a very hard time for a lot of reasons. When the unfortunate incident at Port Arthur took place, I was flying back across the Pacific Ocean from the Olympic test event in Atlanta. They had a World Cup competition there. I'd won the bronze medal. Shot okay, but won the bronze. Landed back in Tullamarine, and a guy from customs said, oh, you'll be popular today. And I'm thinking, it was only a bronze medal. I wasn't really, you know, I just thought he was talking about the fact that I'd won a medal at the test event. When I walked outside of customs, I then was told about what was going on at that particular time at Port Arthur. And the events after that, of course, changed the shooting world, because John Howard brought in his legislation, which I thought was a bit draconian, to be perfectly honest, because they were punishing the law-abiding shooters. They weren't punishing the criminals anymore. They were taking guns off people that they had no reason to. And I was a bit outspoken about it in some areas, but I think when Michael Diamond and myself won in Atlanta, it brought some normality back into the argument, because we'd never given one interview in the 3 months prior to the Olympic Games about how we thought we'd go actually as competitors. Both Michael and I were ranked number one in the world when we went to Atlanta. We were both favourites to win in Atlanta, and we both won. But no one cared about that. They only wanted to know what we thought of John Howard and the legislation. I got sick of it. I was happy to talk about my prospects in Atlanta, but I didn't want to talk about the gun legislation, because it was a huge distraction for us.
And so did you crack it at any stage in media conferences and pre-Olympics interviews?
Absolutely, I did, with a guy called Peter Fitzalan, who was from the Sydney Morning Herald. Peter's obviously a great rugby player for Australia. I knew
Peter Fitzsimons.
Peter Fitzsimons. Peter and I had a few words, because he haunted us in Atlanta. He was at the shooting venue every day. Everyone knows Peter Fitzsimons' views on guns. He's very anti-gun, and he was waiting to write some negative stories, undoubtedly. It turns out for the first week of the Olympics, the only two gold medalists were Michael Diamond and myself. So he was writing these stories that he probably didn't want to write. But in the end, Peter really wrote some very good articles. He defined the difference between the type of shooting that Michael Diamond and myself were doing and the criminals that were misusing guns. And I'm against any criminal that misuses a gun, any person that misuses a firearm. I want to see tougher penalties. Peter wrote some very positive articles about that, and I think that was the difference. If Michael and I hadn't have won in Atlanta, I don't know where we'd be as far as the sport was concerned, because become a huge barrier to entry to get a firearms license to actually come and compete against me. It become difficult. So all of a sudden, these people were thinking, well, this is too hard, let's take up another sport. And some normality and some common sense then took place, and it was not weakened down, but it was the pathway to get a shooter's license was made a little bit easier. And still to this day, if you've got no criminal history, you've got no mental history, you can prove to the police that you can store the firearm safely, you can join our sport. And hopefully it doesn't get any worse, but I hope they punish people that use or misuse firearms even more. That's what we need to concentrate on.
That's in our part of the world. Do you have any views on what happens in the United States? Because they are so insistent that it is in their constitution, the right to bear arms, and yet week after week we see these tragic events happening. You're the person to ask about this. Do you have any feelings about their system?
Yeah, no one likes to see anyone massacred, whether it's with a firearm, a knife, or a motor vehicle. They'll never change it in the United States. If ever they were going to change it, it was after the Sandy Hook massacre. The NRA are a very powerful political body over there that are very tightly knitted with some of the political parties that are having all the say. You can throw up stats to prove or disprove whatever you like. The worrying stat for me is Chicago. Chicago, where handguns are totally banned, there's more crime with handguns there than anywhere else. So I don't know how they're going to legislate against it, because the guns are already in the United States. They're not going to have a buyback like what we did here. That'd send the economy broke over there. There are far more guns than there are people in the United States. What they do, I guess, is their problem. I think the line in the sand has been drawn here in Australia, and I just hope that they can keep it. But it's a tough one, Peter. I mean, You look at some of the countries in the world where Sweden, they have to keep a firearm in their house. Gun crime is the lowest there of any country in the world. It's how you look after your kids and how you bring them up and how you educate them. That's what we've got to do. But socially, I think the biggest problem we have in this country isn't firearms, it's drugs. And that worries me even more.
Yeah, and I think that is going to be an ongoing issue, and that's a whole other argument. Just one last point on your Olympic championship in light of what we're talking about. Here you are. You've got the Olympic gold medal, the gold drink card, as it used to be called back in those days, and I'm sure you probably used that a little bit.
Sure.
Did you feel a stigma from anyone because of what happened in Port Arthur, that they treated you a little bit differently to any other Olympic champion?
Yeah, I did. And it didn't take long for it to happen. After I arrived home from Atlanta, I signed on to do some of the Olympic parades. I was tired when I got home from Atlanta. I didn't want to do the whole tour. I did the Melbourne parade, I did the Sydney parade, and they begged me to do all the others. But I said, I'll do one more. And they said, would you go to Hobart? And of course, Hobart wasn't far from Port Arthur. And yeah, I said, it probably wouldn't be a bad thing for me to go down there. And boy, that was uncomfortable. That was an uncomfortable trip to go to that Olympic parade, because people didn't know how to take me. For the months leading into the Olympics, guns were bad. But all of a sudden here at the Olympic parade in Hobart, there was a guy with an Olympic gold medal that used a gun. And I remember sitting in a hotel foyer with Mike Mackay out of the Awesome Foursome, and he was joking about it. He said, boy, I don't want to be standing with you today on this parade, because they might throw bottles at you. They didn't do that, but it was an uncomfortable time for a shooter that was having a gold medal, that was trying to change his name, I guess. And absolutely, there were people that looked at me differently because I was an Olympic champion, but there were also people down there that looked at me, why are you here? Why it's such bad taste that you're here showing off your Olympic gold medal and the fact you used a gun to do it. I never really felt comfortable on that trip and never really knew how to answer a lot of the questions that were being thrown at me back then.
Was there one particular thing that was said to you at that time that still sticks in your mind that was hurtful or insulting?
There were several people in the crowd as we went through Hobart. Several people, not just one, that said, how do you sleep at night? And that hurts, because Port Arthur had nothing to do with me. My firearm's a tool of my sport. But, you know, people down there took it personally. And I've never been through what they went through. People, obviously, there are a lot of people that lost friends or relatives or whatever. But you can't take it out on the individual. You've, being me, take it out on Martin Bryant. He misused his firearm. He didn't. He used it as a weapon. I use mine as a sporting tool. But no, look, I had to grin and bear it, and it hurt. Undoubtedly, it hurt. But I'm glad I went. I think it at least showed that we weren't trying to hide from it.
Michael Diamond is a name that you've mentioned a couple of times. What's your relationship like with him?
Yeah, oh, look, I spent 20 or 30 years, I guess, with Michael. When he first arrived in the team, he was only a young boy. And, you know, I'm 8 or 9 years older than Mick. But I got to room with him just about everywhere. He was the best guy to room with because Michael would never go back into the room at night and talk about shooting. He'd talk about boats or, you know, just anything abstract. But he was never a guy to dwell on how badly he went that day or how well he went that day. And if you didn't, he would distract you from the competition. By far the best competitor I've ever seen in his event was Michael Diamond. Now, I think if he retired after Rio, he'll put together a resume that I don't think anyone will ever match again. He's going to go to his 7th Olympics at Rio as a competitor, and he's never had a bad one. He's never put in a bad Olympic Games. And he's won 2. He's finished 4th twice. Boy, it was a great person for me to be around, to aspire to. And for 4 Olympics, I shot in the same event that he shot in and then probably specialised in a different event of double trap. But having him in the team, I think, was just the right remedy. You always will perform better if you've got better people in the team. And the old saying that hard to soar with eagles if you mix with turkeys was really true with Michael, because you wouldn't get a bigger eagle to be in the team with.
I've spoken, Russ, to a lot of sports people over the years who talk about having a great mateship with someone who is involved in the same sport. And they have said that just what you're talking about now, that it inspires you probably even more so. The closer the relationship that you have away from your sport, the more intense you want to be to maybe beat that person or draw something from them?
Yeah, it's a very true statement. Just by being around winners, you end up turning into winners because you think like winners. But if you're in a team that's getting absolutely mercilessly flogged at every competition you go to, it's very hard to aspire. But when you've got a person like Michael in the team that won a lot of events very quickly, it dragged the rest of the team up. And I don't think any of us got to the same level that Michael got to, but boy, he dragged a lot of guys close to him, and we were the world champion team in the 90s for quite some time. And from a little country like Australia, that really this isn't our sport, you know, clay target shooting isn't what we're known for, but in the late 90s, everybody wanted to know how the Australian team was training, what we were doing differently. Why did we keep winning gold medals at world championships, not individually, but as a team? And that was one of the things that I enjoyed the most, was winning team gold medals at world titles, flogging the Italians, the Americans, the Russians, the Chinese, all who were on massive budgets, and we were on nothing. It's amazing that we could achieve that.
You've sat at the top of the tree in your sport for a long time, and you've got some views on what happens at the top of the tree, and we'll explore those on the other side of the break. Olympic champion Russell Mark is my guest this morning on This Is Your Sporting Life for Tobin Brothers, Celebrating Lives.
You're listening to This Is Your Sporting Life with Peter Donegan for Tobin Brothers Funerals, Celebrating Lives.
Great to have Russell Mark as our guest on This Is Your Sporting Life. Russ, as we mentioned, you and Michael Diamond were at the top of the tree for a long time in your given sport. Now, you've been a vocal critic about some of the things that go on with the support given to athletes at the top of the tree. Tell us about your take on the Winning Edge program.
Yeah, look, it's no secret I'm not a fan of it. I was on the board of Shooting Australia for 2 stints, and on the end of my 2nd stint, they introduced this program called Winning Edge, which basically means they are going to concentrate to the people right at the top of the pyramid. And I was one of the beneficiaries at the time of Winning Edge because they were pumping a lot of money into the people that were right at the very top. But quickly, I noticed that the pathway into the team was taken away. And, you know, I don't want to generalise and talk about all the other sports that are suffering from Winning Edge, but I can certainly talk about Shooting Australia's problem with it. Well, they don't have a problem. The athletes have the problem. If you're not at the top of the pyramid, it's very, very poor for you. It's the pathway into the team now, it's nearly impossible. And the team now is picked entirely subjectively. And in a sport like shooting, you either hit the target or you miss it. And I grew up in an era where what they call, we used a first-past-the-post policy, which you'd go to several competitions and whoever hit the most went away and represented Australia. And it was a great concept because it made you train all year. You didn't know if you were in the team until the event was finished, and it made you try very, very hard. And the swimmers still use that policy. They still have a national tryout and they have one event. And if you don't hit the pool at the end, either first or second, you're not going to the Olympic Games. And a lot of people say that would be fraught with danger, but it makes those swimmers train so hard that they always hit the end. The good guys always make it. But Winning Edge doesn't pump money into the grassroots level of sport. And unfortunately, it looks like the Twin Towers collapsing in New York. You've got the top and you see it just collapsing underneath. And at international level, this year has been appalling for our shooting team. We didn't win a medal in any of the benchmark events. I couldn't tell you the last time that happened. We had two people make the top 10 for the whole year in the benchmark events. And the benchmark events are events that Shooting Australia and the Sports Commission pick as what they will gauge the team's performance on. And Winning Edge means that the people in the team know they're in the team. They don't have to go to any of these events to try and qualify, so that you get lazy. And unfortunately, it affects your performance. And people will hate me saying this, but I've found Winning Edge to be a policy designed by administrators for administrators. When the Institute of Sport and the Sports Commission busted up a few years ago, there was lots of administrators that needed jobs, and Winning Edge is an expensive policy. And I just see the administrators trying to justify their jobs, but not justifying why their own athletes aren't performing at the same level. They tell me they want 10 years of this policy. So what they're saying is, if we don't do well in Rio, give us a crack at Tokyo as well. Well, by Tokyo in our sport, there'll be no one left. We had an event which was an Australian team selection event, they called it, in Perth, in my event, just 3 or 4 weeks back at the start of September. They had 5 people turn up. 5 people. You know, that tells you that no one's even going to try this anymore, because no matter how well they shoot at that event, they're not going to be selected on it. That it's going to be selected in a boardroom and favourites will get picked in the team. And it's sad.
Do you think it discriminates more against the lower profile sports, because people will always jump in the pool and they will always swim because it's a very high profile sport in Australia? Even track and field, which doesn't have the profile that it does in Europe, but it's still high profile. Does it discriminate more against sports like yours, the lesser profile sports?
Absolutely, because the administrators in those lower profile sports won't take on the Sports Commission. They won't fight them on this policy, because a lot of the administrators in these lower profile sports are on their way to becoming administrators in hopefully higher profile sports. Mm. So they don't take on the administration and they just let the Sports Commission dictate. And for the sport of shooting, the Winning Edge policy has been a shocking policy. And the facts of the matter is that the results speak for themselves. And it's a really worrying thing to be a board member of a body like Shooting Australia and see the sport just destruct in front of you. And I copped a lot of criticism for being on the board of Shooting Australia when this policy was introduced. But I've done everything since I've got off the board to try and get them to reassess it, to go back to a first-past-the-post policy, which the same people, Peter, will qualify for the team. They'll just train harder to do it. And no one's suggesting the athletes that they're sending at the moment aren't the best athletes, but they're not the best-trained athletes anymore. And that's a problem.
Well, let's move on to another subject. I've bumped into you many times over the years, and I must say, sitting in the studio here, you're looking as fit as I've ever seen you. You dropped a fair bit of weight, didn't you, not that long ago?
Yeah, look, I always found it an advantage to be bigger when you competed. And I've probably spent a lot of time in the gym and doing a lot of other things. In my event, recoil becomes a big factor and you're firing 2 shots every time. And I found whenever I competed and I went crazy and lost a lot of weight, the recoil problem would really hurt me. So I found it easier and better to perform when I was probably 5 or 6 kilos heavier than what I am now. And you know, largely that's a physical thing, and it's a physics thing. Recall becomes a big factor in my event after you fired 200 shots. So the bigger you are, the more you absorb the recall. Little people like my wife, she suffered a lot from it because she was probably 50 kilograms ringing wet, and at the end of the day, it was like she'd been five rounds with Muhammad Ali, whereas I probably wore it a lot better.
So do you have any ongoing issues, or does Lauren have any ongoing issues from the fact that you are firing, you're practicing all the time? Does it cause your body any stresses? Because we see footballers years down the track with a terrible gait, they can hardly walk. Do you have any lasting impressions from your sport?
I was lucky that in 1992, our international body identified there were a lot of people like me that was just shooting too much, and they reduced the amount of lead that you're allowed in your shotgun cartridges. So in 1992, they reduced it back, it went all the way back from 36 grams originally, all the way down to 24 grams, which is a massive amount of lead taken out of the shotgun ammunition. Without getting too technical about this, but what that does, it reduces the recoil of the shotgun shell. The shotgun shells we use at the Olympics aren't the type of shotgun shell that you'd go hunting with or anything, because there's hardly any shot in them, which means it doesn't hurt you as much. So luckily, at the early part of my career, this rule change came in. But a lot of the older guys I see now, they've all got sore backs, sore necks. I escaped pretty injury-free from it.
We're going to take our final break. When we come back on the other side of the break, it often happens with this program. We're going to, sometimes we do the program upside down. We'll find out how you got into your sport and also whether there might have been another sport that you might have excelled at apart from injury dictating otherwise. Russell Mark is our special guest on This Is Your Sporting Life for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
You're listening to This Is Your Sporting Life with Peter Donegan for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
Into our final segment with Olympic champion Russell Mark. Russ, as I said, sometimes I finish up doing the show backwards. When did you first pick up a gun and thought, I can make something of this?
Look, it was back in Ballarat. It would have been when I was about 14. I remember I used to play football for East Ballarat. I rolled my ankle at footy training one night. I couldn't play in the match on the weekend. I went along and watched them play at a football ground called Sebastopol. Behind the ground at Sebastopol, there was a guy shooting clay targets at the clay target range. He knew my father, who'd done a little bit of shooting, or I shouldn't say a little bit. He did quite a lot of shooting, but not at the same level that I did it at. But he knew my father, and he knew that my father wouldn't have minded giving me a shot. I had a shot at some clay targets and I couldn't miss any. It was one of these stupid things. I went back and played football, but it always had it in my mind, this sport may be for me, because I had good hand-eye coordination, but I didn't realise how good until I entered a novice competition that this guy had entered me into about 3 months later, and missed my last shot in it and finished second. And I often say if I had have hit that last shot in that novice competition, I would have taken up shooting when I was about 50. But it hurt me that much, I went back and did it again and was very successful early on. And my mother was a champion golfer, though, and I played a lot of golf with her. And boy, I look at Jason Day now, I think, boy, well, I made the wrong decision. I loved golf and I still love golf, but I just didn't have the time to put in it. But if I had my time again, I often said I would have played golf. But I sort of love the nature of the sport. I love the way the people play it. I love how they hold themselves. It's the last gentleman sporting. It's the way they conduct themselves. I really find it's an admiring sport. And I'll probably try and push one of my kids that way, because I don't know. One of them will want to shoot. I know my little boy would, but women's golf, and I've got two daughters, but one of them, I definitely think she's got the temperament for it and she's got the build for it. So if I had my time again, that's where I'd go.
Oh, well, hopefully if I'm still doing the women's game in a few years' time, I might be calling her.
Absolutely.
You talked about the injury in footy. Could you have made a career of footy? How talented were you?
Look, I was a centre-half forward, full forward, but I stopped growing at about 6'1". And I was a Carlton tragic, and I still am now, and that's just killing me lately.
Can't help bad luck,
yeah,
mate.
I know. I wasn't going to be tall or fast enough to take it any further. I grew up in the same era as Tony Lockett, and playing against Tony, that terrified me, so I probably didn't have the courage to take on the likes of Tony. But watching him grow up, he wasn't in the same team, but certainly played in the same competition, I was never the build. I never had it, what was required. And they're great athletes, the AFL guys, and I was never built for that.
What does life hold for Russell Mark now? You're travelling at various places around the world, doing a bit of coaching.
Yeah, I still do a fair bit of freelance coaching. I put away a fair bit of money and I invested in a couple of hotels, which I built out in Hoppers Crossing. I got a couple of gaming licences and built two pubs out there. So financially, that, I guess, is what it holds for me, because that's a big-time venture to look after them. But the only thing I have to do with the sport now in Australia is I coach the guy that will be taking my place at the Rio Olympics, a young guy called James Willett, who finished fourth in the World Championship in Italy just a few weeks back. I think he's a chance to go on and do great things. So that's at least kept me in the sport. But I haven't had the desire to compete again at any level since I retired last year. So I won't be going on the Masters Tour or anything like that. I competed long enough. I'm happy with what I've done. But the kids, that's probably the number one thing. That once you have three children, you don't have any time left to do anything else.
Yeah. You say that you don't miss competition. Are there aspects of being at the top level of your sport, though, that you do miss at this time?
Oh, the teams events. I think it's great to win world championships individually or Olympics individually, but when we had the best team in the world and you'd go to these exotic places and everyone would look at the Australian team, they're great memories to be part of an era where Australia was the best in the world. And it's sad to see now we can't even enter a team in the World Teams event. We haven't even got enough to fill the team up anymore. That part hurts to see that happen. But, yeah, the memories of the camaraderie, because it's such an individual sport. Mm. The only teams competition we have is at the World Championship. I miss that particular aspect.
What you're talking about reminds me of a sport that you just touched on, golf, and that is such an individual sport. Then you see something like the Ryder Cup, or you see the Solheim Cup, which was conducted just a couple of months ago for the women, and you see that bond that they establish. For individual sports people, when they get in that team environment, it means something.
Yeah, it's a great analogy, Pete, and the sports are very similar, and the Ryder Cup, the President's Cup, you see how much it means to these people to make those teams. Well, I was the same. To be part of a team meant so much, and we'd only do it once every couple of years, but boy, when you're in it, you really treasured the memories.
One last question. Are we going to have an Olympic shooting champion for Australia before we have a Carlton Premiership?
Our women's trap team are genuinely world and Olympic champion prospects. There's a young lady called Letitia Scanlon and another young lady called Catherine Skinner. They could win in Rio, and despite all the problems that I say with the winning edge policy, they've managed to weave their way through it. Listen for those names. I think they could be our next Olympic champions. Carlton, I don't know. I'm 51. I don't know how long I've got to live, Pete.
I'm sure they'll be there. They're a great organisation, and great organisations don't stay down for too long.
I hope you're right, mate. I hope you're right. 95, that was the last premiership I watched them win.
Oh, well, it's got to be due. Russ, it's been a pleasure to talk to you. Congratulations on all you've achieved, and it's been wonderful to sit down and celebrate your life. Thanks to Tobin Brothers on This Is Your Sporting Life.
Thanks, Peter.
Russell Mark joining us, and don't forget, we will be back here same place, same time next Sunday on 11:16 SEN.